From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with South African musician Hugh Masekela. He came to America to play bebop, but ended up as a leading figure in Afropop. Also today, I speak with Lulla Rosenfeld. She's written a history of Yiddish theater in America. It's a history her family helped shape. Rosenfeld's grandfather was one of the Yiddish theater's biggest stars, Jacob Adler. And we'll have reviews of a new album from the Midwest rock group Shoes and of the new Australian film High Tide. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Hugh Masekela's record, Grazin' in the Grass, was a top 10 hit in 1968. In some ways, that record foreshadowed the current international popularity of Afropop. That's African music influenced by rock, soul, and jazz. Masekela is a South African composer and trumpeter who left his country in the early 60s on a music scholarship and never returned. After his brief commercial success in the United States, he spent much of the 70s performing in African countries, touring with some of the top African bands. He recently returned to the spotlight in the United States when he performed on Paul Simon's Graceland tour. Masekela just concluded a series of concerts with exiled South African singer Miriam Makeba, to whom he was briefly married after he first came to America. His music is also represented on Broadway in the current hit show Sarafina. Before we hear from Hugh Masekela, let's listen to an excerpt from his latest album called Tomorrow. This is a song he co-composed called Bring 'Em Back Home about Nelson Mandela. Masekela is featured on trumpet and vocals. This was recorded live in concert in Harare, Zimbabwe. Masekela, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by talking with you about growing up in South Africa and then work our way to the work that you're doing now. Now, the first instrument that you played was piano before you switched to trumpet. Was it hard to get access to a piano growing up in South Africa?
No, you know, from the turn of the century, South Africa had ragtime bands and revues and Dixieland bands because there was a big industrial boom there with the discovery of all the minerals and... As a result, I would say that a great onslaught was experienced from the international money community. And they brought their Victrolas and their records with them, and they brought their instruments, and there was radio and all that. So the Africans, as a cheap labor force, but also people who liked, who had ears for music, had a lot of access to instruments. There were brass bands and... They were like black bottom joints and shebeens and municipal halls where a whole lot of bands played. And there were, I mean, in South Africa today, when you walk around, there's guys called Jelly Roll or Buddy Bolden or Satchmo or Duke or Count, you know. And
so you listened to a lot of jazz yourself when you were growing up?
I was weaned on jazz. So, like, there was a whole lot of piano players and also a lot of classical piano players in the townships. And the role model, really, of South African township life, I think, was like the African-American experience of like the African people who, after the so-called emancipation, you know, came to the cities as cheap labor. They were able to popularize America, although it was Jim Crow to them, you know, through their music. And like, we grew up with Duke Ellington and Cy Oliver and Cab Calloway and Louis Armstrong and Buddy Bolden and Jelly Roll Morton and King Oliver,
you played
Baby Dolls, you know, uh-huh, I could go uh-huh. on forever.
Yeah. Really. You played in a lot of bands when you were growing up. Now, I understand that one of the bands you played in was the first black show that authorities allowed whites and quote, mixed races to see. What was that experience like? Is that true, first of all? I always have to check these things.
Well, I would say that, but I played in African Jazz and Variety. When I joined African Jazz and Variety, they were like a big touring review of 60 people, you know. Miriam Makeba joined it about a year after I did. But it had all like the singing stars of South Africa. And it had also groups like the Woodpeckers, who were like a cross between a rhythm and blues group maybe, and the Hi-Los, you know, the Four Freshmen with the township thing. And there was a comedian, there was, you know, a guy who could sing like Nat King Cole, one guy could sing like Satch, and these all are big stars. But in certain towns, like in Cape Town, which was like a very liberal town then, and in Durban, they would allow mixed crowds, but they would be so far from the townships anyway that only, I would say, like people who had cars or access to transport, because the townships are about 15 to 20 miles out of town, would be able to come. And a lot of people who had like what I'd call permits, because when you were black in South Africa, you had to have a night pass to be in an urban area, a white area, after 9 o'clock in the evening. And you'd have to have a night pass and a letter signed by either your boss or your employer if you're a musician. And so it didn't make it very easy, but I don't think there was ever excitement in South Africa in token being, you know, sort of a token member of an integrated concert or integrated right. this and that, because the reality of the place has always been, I mean, I think South Africans are basically, oppressed South Africans are very clear when they focus on what they want. And I don't think it's so much to integrate with people as much as to be as free as them and be able to have a choice, just like all free people have, you know. When, for instance, the Morality Act was cut out in South Africa, where people were not supposed to make love across the color line. And when they took that, they thought there'd be like a big onslaught of interracial coupling and all that. But people have basically ignored it, because I don't think that it encompasses their vision of what freedom is about, or what freedoms are about.
My guest is trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela. When you left South Africa, you left on a music scholarship to study in England and America. How were you able to get the scholarship? And I should ask you first, did you plan on leaving for good? Did you want to get out of South Africa for good when you accepted that scholarship?
Well, when I was 13 years old, I saw a movie about the great Bix Beiderbecke called Young Man with a Horn.
Oh, yeah, with Kirk Douglas.
Right.
Yeah.
And at that time, I was in boarding school, and the school belonged to a community of monks from England called the Community of the Resurrection, of which Trevor Huddleston, which is Bishop Trevor Huddleston now, and is head of anti-apartheid and defense and aid, you know, it's, in England, was the chaplain of and the superior of this community. And they worked in health, welfare, and education among Africans. And he was also kind of a hoodlum priest. And I was going through a very rough time with the authorities at the boarding school. And I was called to him, and he said, "What do you really want to do? Because you're so young to expel." And I said, "Father, I just saw a movie called Young Man with a Horn, and if I can get a trumpet, I'll never bother anybody again." So he went to the local store and said, "You know, I got £15. There's a guy who might come and steal this horn if we, you know, can make a deal and buy it for him." And of course, the rest was history. But from there on, I got into like, you know, I was already past swing. And I was a very big collector. I'd, you know, growing up with my aunts and uncles, and my parents were all very, very big collectors of the breakable 78s. And I got into bebop. So by the time I was 15, 16, I was playing with Mbaqanga bands and with like groups like African Jazz. When it went on the road and Township Jazz and jazz groups and modern jazz concerts and mostly dance bands, but I started to become a student of bebop, and that pulled me more and more into like my horn and into like figuring that. I had such a deep love, you know, for, I mean, I had enjoyed Dizzy Gillespie, I enjoyed Louis Armstrong and, you know, trumpeters of before, but people like Miles Davis and Fats Navarro and like Clifford Brown especially just blew me away. And I said, well, I have to be able to go where these guys can learn to play like that. And I knew that, of course, the main destination was New York. I mean, there was people in Johannesburg who were jazz collectors who could tell you where Charlie Parker was playing anywhere in the States on a certain date and who'd be on bass and who'd be on drums. Someone that were really very deep into it and they could, like, skate along with all the songs.
Well, when you got to America and you actually had some access to the people who you'd been listening to for so long, were you able to play with them? And did your rhythms, which were kind of African-based jazz, work well with theirs?
When I got here, I was really a hard, you know, bebop player, but everybody and all the musicians that I met, especially, you know, Dizzy and Belafonte, said, well, you know, a whole lot of people can do what you're doing, you know, as far as bebop is concerned, but there's something else that you have from your home, and if you can sort of come to a marriage with what you have traditionally or like just culturally from your home with what you know about the music here, you might come out with a hybrid of your own that people might be turned on to.
Well, you know, the record that introduced you to most Americans was the 1968 top 10 hit Grazin' in the Grass. I want to play just a few seconds of that to just remind our listeners of how the record sounded. And I should tell you, this is an old, scratchy copy from a friend's collection. So we'll just play a few seconds of it just to refresh memories about Yu Masekela's 1968 hit. A lot of our listeners have copies as scratchy as that one. what was the story? Yeah. What was the story behind the song? Was that the song that you wanted to record? And
I think the majority of the people who bought that record or danced to it are grandparents now. No, this record. I went to Los Angeles in 1966 because of a record I made live at the Village Gate with the late Tom Wilson, who at the time was also producing Bob Dylan and Paul Simon, someone in Garfunkel, among other things. But this record we did live at the Gate, and it broke out after 2 years. We did it in 64, and in 66 it became like the number one record in California. And I went there to play the first Watts Jazz Festival. I'd been playing as an opening band all the time at the Village Gate from time to time. And when I played the first Watts Festival, the night I played, over 15,000 people came, and it was like a record attendance. So I called my friend, Stuart Levine, you know, later became my partner and produced most of my albums. I said, man, this is the place we should be, not coming back. So I had quite a big success in California. And in 1967, I recorded a cover of The Fifth Dimension's Up, Up and Away, and that went into the top 30. And I started traveling all over the country, and I took a vacation and went to see my sister who was at university in Lusaka. A lot of friends who hadn't seen me for 7 years came from Johannesburg, and you know, they brought like tape and pieces of stuff. And when I came back, I had a lot of Mbaqanga music. And the late El Abreu, who played with me on Grazing and in that quintet I had, We were in the studio doing that album, Promise of a Future. We needed about 4 minutes more on the album, and we didn't have another song. And Ella Brewer said, remember that? So he liked it very much. He said, there's that song, man, that you always play, that we always play. You know, we should try and do that because it's a simple part. So I just showed the piano player what to do and sang the four notes to the bass player, and we did it in one take. And 6 weeks later, it was number one.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music and your life, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela, and we'll talk more after this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
South African trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela is my guest. Before we talk more, I want to play some more of your music. There's a hit on Broadway called Serafina now, and you wrote some of the music for that, and you were one of the people behind the creation of the show. I want to play the title song from Serafina, which you wrote. Hugh Masekela doesn't perform on this, but you wrote the music and the lyrics, or just the music?
Well, I collaborated with the director, Mbongeni Ngema. Okay. And
you did the horn arrangements on this as well.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, it was like really a collaboration because most of it was rehearsed in South Africa, and then we rehearsed it here for 2 months, and added this and took that and that out. But it was basically, it's been like a 2-year collaboration.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen. The title song from the Broadway hit Serafina, and my guest Hugh Masekela composed that. You know, after that hit in 1968 that we were talking about, Grazing in the Grass, I think a lot of people lost track of you. You went to Africa for a long time in the 1970s. Did you kind of give up on America for a period there?
Not really. I mean, to a certain extent, coming from an oppressed people, And having a major success at the level and the brouhaha to which it goes, you know, in its marketplace. And, of course, it was also a period of, like, anti-Vietnam War activity. And it was, like, the Black Power situation. And a conservative government had just come in who were, like, a very anti-musician. And I'd been living in California, and I just felt I'd peaked, but like that the success was irrelevant in juxtaposition to the position of my people. And although South Africa was inaccessible to me, I just felt like I should get back into somewhere in Africa. And I was crazy about the music of Zaire and of Ghana and Guinea and Nigeria. And I had a few friends there, so I gave myself an open ticket.
Was that a good experience for you? What I'm thinking is, you said when you got to New York that a lot of the jazz musicians who you wanted to play with said to you, do what's unique to you. Play African music as well. Everyone, you know, plays bebop. Play what's what's really like your music. And there you were in Africa getting reunited with musical, with African musical forms. Was that a good experience for you, a kind of growth experience musically?
I think it was very spiritual too, because it was a pilgrimage. I was from Africa, but I'd never been there.
You'd only stayed in your township?
Right, in South Africa. Well, and I've been all over South Africa, and I'd been to Botswana once, but it's different, you know. I spent 7 years where I lived with, you know, the peoples of Guinea, of Ghana, of Zaire, of Nigeria, and I got to learn the languages and, you know, the slang and the way to walk and talk and just the culture and tradition there. And it was a great revelation to me, also like from a socio-political view. I got to know what Africa is like. I mean, I've traveled all over Senegal, Togo, Benin, Kenya. And there's nothing like seeing it firsthand. And of course, once it bites you, you always have to go back. I kept making glimpses into the States with the African band from West Africa, but I was experiencing, I was absorbing the continent.
What's your status now with South Africa? Could you return there? Are you officially in exile, if you know what I mean?
My status with South Africa is that I don't recognize the government thereof. Mm-hmm. And that's our status. That's our relationship. You know, I don't think they think what we who oppose them stand for is a legitimate stand, because they live in a world that is almost cultist, you know, in its form and philosophy. So it's a situation where I don't recognize the government or its rules. I don't think they can exile me. You know what I mean? I'm in self-exile because of the situations in South Africa. And I've been, not only outspoken in South Africa, but to a certain extent, very harsh when I've had access to the media. So I don't think I'm one of their favorite people, but that's not the aim. The aim is to be able to define them to the world so the world can see them as they really are. And what they really are is an occupying force in the townships and the schools and hospitals and homes and minds of the people who own the country where they have in bondage. And it's like a situation where it's worse than a slave state.
Do you still have your recording studio in Botswana?
In 1985, the South African government sent commandos into Gaborone to come and murder political exiles whose homes they claimed were terrorist camps. And of course, a lot of these people were friends and or relatives of mine. And of course, although my house was not so much pinpointed as a terrorist house, it was nevertheless, when I was laying there with my wife for 2 hours listening to the commandos murder and bomb people all over the place, it was a definite sign that it was not the greatest place to live in. And of course, other messages were sent based on that. The government really couldn't secure that they could, you know, guarantee our security, you know, especially South African exiles who were outspoken against the government. And it felt like a time to go. So we just had to get rid of the studio, too, instead of seeing it go up in smoke.
I don't want to go into the whole thing about, you know, you toured with Graceland in America, and I don't want to go into the whole thing again about whether you think it was okay for Paul Simon to record in South Africa. But I'm curious if you're ambivalent yourself about the performance and recording ban in South Africa.
Well, I think that just like I don't recognize the South African government, I don't think that people can, like, overseas elect themselves to, like, sort of judge and make a way of how South African music should be made accessible to people in the world. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And myself personally, when I worked in Botswana, I was criticized for working with South African governments. And I always said to everybody, if I can't work with the people of my country, you know, who I admire and I have access to them and they have access to me, then there'll be something wrong with me, because I'll be pulling them back, because my aim is for them to be able to have the same recognition that I've gotten, or even better, because a lot of them are better than that. Otherwise, I mean, like a person like Jonathan Butler just came out recently should be illegal because it still goes home. But we're proud of our talents, and all the people in the townships are proud of their musicians. They boast about them, and they're always like a football team. Or, you know, say, if we send out people overseas, you know, they could, like, kick some butt, you know, or, like, show what they can really do. And that is an aspiration that we have for all our people. So based on that, I think that whoever put up the rules, I mean, since then the situation has been settled, but they were aware that if anything, they should have had some kind of delegation from the South African Music and Arts Committee before they could make decisions for them. Because when Paul went to South Africa, he didn't go to perform, he didn't go to take anything from them, but he took his own expertise, technology, and money out of something that had affected him very, very emotionally and spiritually. And I think he did a fantastic job with it because Mambazo's won a Grammy. People had forgotten about Miriam, and I just finished a very successful tour with her. She has a book out, and she has a record out that has been getting rave reviews everywhere. I think that without Sarafina, also, have had more exposure also through Graceland and, of course, a lot of South African musicians and African music as a whole. And between the Grammys and the reception we've got from what I call non-converts, you know, because sometimes, like, the converts think that, like, this situation just belongs to them. But I think what was greatest about Graceland is that it brought something that people thought was belonged to a private club. It brought it to the back gardens of the barbecuing middle and upper middle class. And they found that even when they like South African music, that as simple as that, they found that there's a problem there. And those 10 million people we didn't have on our side before Graceland, you know. And it's to a certain extent, traditionally, we just feel that a thing like that is not an accident and it's spiritual. But the fantastic thing is that not only did Paul share his royalties with all the writers and still has a great relationship with everybody and is very happy about it's been uplifting for him, it's been uplifting for the people in South Africa too and for African musicians as a whole. And
you've been touring now with Miriam McCabe. I think that the tour has just concluded.
Yeah.
What's it been like again to perform together again? When you came to America, she helped you out a lot, and then you were married for a while as well. Has that been an interesting reunion?
Well, even though Miriam was not here, and I've been performing with Miriam all through the years, through the last 17 years, because we perform all over Africa.
I see.
And we perform all over Europe, where I think people are not as narrow-minded, from especially a governmental position, to like ban or blacklist artists, you know, for their beliefs. So I've always been on her records. I've produced a lot of her records, and I work with her all the time.
Okay.
And it was a great, great opportunity when we had an opportunity to work here together, but it was nothing new to us.
One last thing. Do people still see you and just associate you with Grazing in the Grass, or is that all over? Do you have, like, a separate identity from that in America for most listeners?
I have a multi-identity in this country because I've been here for 28 years, and through those years I've evolved so many times that it depends on one's age, you know.
Right, right. Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for interviewing.
My guest has been South African trumpeter and composer Hugh Masekela, and he wrote some of the music for the Broadway hit Sarafina. He's also just concluded a tour with Miriam McCabe. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with poet W.S. Merwin. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1970 for his book The Carrier of Letters. I hope you can join us. Here's more music from Hugh Masekela's latest album, Tomorrow.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the granddaughter of the Yiddish King Lear. The Yiddish King Lear is the role that made Jacob Adler one of the Yiddish theater's biggest stars. Lola Adler Rosenfeld has written a book about her grandfather. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker checks out Shoes, a Midwest band that flirted with success in the 70s. Ken says they have a new album on the way that could give them a well-deserved second chance. And guest film critic Michael Schrago reviews High Tide, the new Australian film from Gillian Armstrong, the woman who made My Brilliant Career. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. The White House today refused comment on an offer made to Panamanian General Manuel Noriega. Officials have proposed dropping drug charges against Noriega in return for his leaving the country. Details from NPR's Brian Naylor.
The discussions going on between the U.S. and Noriega were likened to a plea bargain by White House Chief of Staff Howard Baker today. He said the agreement was hypothetical at this point, but that such a deal could be beneficial to all if it resulted in Noriega's leaving Panama and paved the way for democratic government in that country. Other reactions, however, were less charitable. Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato of New York.
What we have here is an administration that set its hair on fire and is trying to put it out with a hammer.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater shrugged off such criticism, saying the main U.S. policy objective is to get Noriega out. But the administration has clearly left itself open to criticism by, on the one hand, calling for the death penalty for drug kingpins, while on the other appearing ready to drop charges against an alleged major figure in the international drug trade. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
George Bush today shrugged off suggestions that President Reagan's support for his presidential bid is less than enthusiastic. Campaigning in New Mexico, Bush said he couldn't be more pleased with the president's endorsement. Mr. Reagan announced his support for Bush in the last three sentences of a speech he delivered last night at a Republican fundraiser in Washington. Bush refused to answer questions about the president's offer to drop drug charges against Manuel Noriega. Several leaders of the outlawed Farmers' Solidarity Union were detained by police in Warsaw today. Despite the arrests, hundreds of Polish farmers attended a mass at Warsaw Cathedral where opposition leaders announced the union's reemergence. The union was dissolved by the communist government after martial law was imposed in 1981 to crack down on the Solidarity Trade Union. In Gdansk, workers returned to their jobs at the Lenin shipyard after the collapse of a nine-day strike led by Solidarity. Secretary of State George Shultz and Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze say they have resolved U.S.-Soviet differences over the INF Treaty. In separate news conferences, both men said they are pleased with the outcome of their 2 days of talks in Geneva, but they ruled out a strategic nuclear weapons agreement in time for the Moscow summit later this month. Jeremy Bowen has details.
Mr. Shultz said he was completely satisfied with the discussions on INF. He sent the National Security Advisor, Colin Powell, back to Washington to brief the treaty's critics in the Senate. To give them more reassurance, the U.S. and the Soviet Union have made two new agreements, one dealing with the contentious aspects of INF and the other dealing with so-called futuristic weapons that haven't been invented yet. Some senators are worried that they weren't covered by the INF treaty. Even without the hoped-for deal on strategic weapons, both Mr. Shultz and Mr. Shevardnadze say they're looking forward to a successful summit. But attention now shifts to Washington, where the Senate will have to decide whether Mr. Shultz and Mr. Shevardnadze's compromise is acceptable. For National Public Radio, this is Jeremy Bowen in Geneva.
Israeli warplanes attacked a Palestinian guerrilla base south of Beirut, Lebanon, today. This was the eighth Israeli air raid into Lebanon this year. Lebanese police said that six fighter planes hit the base in three bombing runs. There was no immediate report on casualties or damage. According to the police, the target appeared to be a base of the PLO faction called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command. The group is backed by Syria and reportedly financed by Libya. The group claimed responsibility for the hang glider attack into northern Israel last November that killed six Israeli soldiers. And a large car bomb exploded today near the barracks for the Christian Lebanese forces in a village north of Beirut. There were no immediate reports of casualties. The car was parked when it exploded. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the rock music world, most bands try to make it big by following the advice of agents and promoters and moving to L.A. or New York. But for over 10 years, a band from the Midwest called Shoes has persisted in believing that they will eventually make it big on their own terms. They've just released a retrospective album called Shoes Best. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Of the many rock bands that emerged in the late 70s, the one whose commercial failure I regret most is that of Shoes, a quartet from Zion, Illinois. Shoes was formed by two brothers, Jeff and John Murphy, who recruited two boyhood chums, guitarist Gary Klebe and drummer Skip Meyer. They practiced on their instruments and wrote songs in the Murphy family basement. When they started out, Jeff and John still lived with their parents, and they eventually built a small recording studio there. In 1977, when all the Shoes were in their early 20s, they cut an album on a 4-track tape recorder in the Murphys' living room. The record that resulted was called Black Vinyl Shoes. That song, Boys Don't Lie, typifies the sound of Shoes. The vocals are breathy harmonies. Jeff and John sang the leads most often, and they took an almost perverse pride in keeping the listener from knowing whose voice was whose. The melodies were always quick and catchy with strong lead guitar lines. You could pick out the influences, the Beatles above all, but also the mannerly charm of the early Beach Boys and the ironic detachment of good Beatle rip-off bands like Badfinger and The Move. Black Vinyl Shoes attracted quite a few positive reviews from the critics to whom Shoes sent their album. They had nothing to do with the punk rock that was beginning to rage across the rock world, but that probably helped the band stand out. Elektra Records, a major label that was home to The Doors and The Cars, decided it wanted some Shoes and signed the band. That's I Don't Miss You from the first album Shoes recorded for Elektra called Present Tense. By now, the Murphys' sound was thicker, denser, more intricate. The lyrics tended to be about bad love affairs or love affairs that existed only in the mind of the young man singing the song. Present Tense was a commercial bomb, and with its failure, Shoes crossed a line. Before this, the band's music implied hope and ambition. But after it, the music turns in on itself. It doesn't seem to reach out to the broadest audience possible. Or at least that's what I hear in a song from the Shoes album called Tongue Twister. The night you call me up, it shook me up a lot. I knew you'd had a fight. Cry away, but not on my shoulder. You run in my pursuit of the dreams you lost when they disappeared. The story's clear. That's Burned Out Love. Shoes recorded 3 albums for Elektra before they were dropped. One of the most interesting things about the band is the way, right from the start, they wanted to control their image by having no image at all. They gave very few interviews. More intriguingly, they refused to go out on a cross-country tour, something most fledgling rock bands are expected to do as a matter of course. Yet in 1981, as if despite Elektra Records, Shoes put out their own live album, a concert recorded in their hometown at the Zion Ice Arena. The Murphys are big hockey fans and players, and they called their live album, what else, Shoes on Ice. Maybe once in a while we'll feel the same things happen. Coming After such an odd, aimless career, it's almost amazing that Shoes still exists. The liner notes to this collection tell us that there's a forthcoming album, to be called Stolen Wishes, and the CD includes one new song from this project as a kind of teaser. I hope the album, when it comes out, brings Shoes the success the band wants on its own small-time terms. And here's that new song called Love Is Like a Bullet.
The last time it took me down, I didn't see it coming, no time to look around. It hit me from the blind side, I didn't see. She shot me down in cold blood and dropped me to my knees. Put an end to this deadly cry, a broken-hearted homicide. Love is like a bullet.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Lulla Adler Rosenfeld's childhood memories are intertwined with the history of the Yiddish theater in America. Her grandfather was Jacob Adler, one of Yiddish theater's biggest stars. Her book that began as a biography of her grandfather expanded into a history of the Yiddish theater. A revised edition titled The Yiddish Theater and Jacob P. Adler has just been published. Lulla Adler Rosenfeld visited Philadelphia this week in conjunction with a Smithsonian traveling exhibit called Hooray for the Yiddish Theater in America. She donated much of the exhibit's material on Jacob Adler. I asked her to share some of her personal recollections of her grandfather.
The earliest memories I have, the first years, I spent with him in his house.
Living there or visiting?
Living in his house. And I knew him. He was the center of a family. He was everything.
The Yiddish theater was banned in Russia, where your grandfather grew up. It was banned under Alexander III. Is that why he left Russia?
Yes, it is. That's why he left.
Is that what started the wave of Yiddish theater in America?
Yes.
So he went to London first.
He went to London.
And then moved to New York.
Yes.
And got to New York in the late 1880s.
Right.
What was the state of Yiddish theater when he came to America?
It was the worst theater you can imagine. It was very, very bad, worse than it had even been in the very earliest times in Russia. It was just, they had these historical operettas that were simply a lot of bombastic nonsense that had nothing to do with history. It mixed three eras together in one operetta. And very few people came. It had a tiny little audience came. Many of them had never even heard of theater till they came to America. They came to see these shows. But Adler was the one who rebelled against the historical operettas. He took his own theater and he started to do plays from the European repertoire.
One of the roles he became most famous for was in a play that was called Jewish King Lear.
Yes.
What was the Jewish version, the Yiddish version of King Lear like?
This was written by Gordon. He was not a king. He was a Russian Jewish merchant of very great wealth, a very great personal authority, the ruler of his family. It was a type that was very familiar to that audience. They remembered that type. They remembered that king.
Do you remember any of the Yiddish soliloquies or speeches in this play?
I certainly do, because I remember, the thing I remember about the Yiddish King Lear is a memory of my grandfather saying that exit in the third act when he said, when he said, give alms to the Yiddish King Lear. I remember it to this day. It was a cry. It rang through the theater.
How does it sound in Yiddish?
Schenkt an der Duvid, der jiddischer König Lea, he used to say.
Now, it's interesting. Your grandfather, Jacob Adler, as you say, he didn't want to perform in the historical operettas. He didn't really want to sing either. And a lot of Yiddish theater was, musical comedy.
He couldn't sing.
He couldn't sing.
But he said in his memoirs that was not why he would have gone to purely dramatic roles in any case, because he had a different image of what the actor should do. And he said he didn't want to amuse the public, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to awaken the deepest emotions of their soul, is what he said. That is what he felt the actor should do.
There was, a kind of classic split in the Yiddish theater between the highbrow and the lowbrow. We see this in just about every art form and entertainment form. What was the split like in the Yiddish theater? The lowbrow stuff, so to speak, was called what? Schund, am I saying that right?
Schund, that's absolutely right. It's a German word and also a Yiddish word, which means trash.
Mm-hmm.
And it existed from the beginning, and it always existed. There was a certain period right after the Yiddish King Lear when everybody wanted to play good theater, because that was such a hit, and also everybody was so thrilled by what had happened. And the big audience started coming after that play. The intellectuals came, and the Zionists came, and the socialists came, and that big, big, big working class masses started to come, and it became a big theater after that. But Schund, there was a big gradation of Schund. Some of it was almost good theater. At its worst, it was worse than the worst Bowery thrillers. It was ridiculous nonsense. Any kind of junk that could be put on the stage with the sensationalism and all the nonsense that went on. It was very funny, some of it. And
funny intentionally funny? Or
No, not intentionally okay. Funny. Unintentionally funny. But I loved it all. I don't care what they did. I loved everything they did.
You come from quite a theater family. Your grandfather, Jacob Adler, was an actor, and then your Aunt Stella Adler, an actor and teacher. Your Uncle Luther Adler, an actor. Your mother and father were both actors.
It was three generations back on both sides of my father and mother, all actors, three generations back.
Do you think it was kind of typical for there to be acting families coming out of the Yiddish theater?
Yes, it was.
Why?
Because a lot of the actors went out on the road and they made troupes of their own family. But the Adlers, it so happened, all got famous. So that's the family that's known.
So when you were coming of age, was it just kind of understood that you would start your life as an actress?
No, it wasn't. I could have done whatever I liked.
But you wanted to act?
I sort of fell into it.
Did you ever get up on the stage and feel that your performance did not meet with the approval of your family?
Oh, yes, I did.
And what were the consequences of that?
They were very, very outspoken about it. They said, "What were you doing there?" They weren't kind a bit.
Did that make it hard for you to get your confidence that you needed?
It was very hard, yes. It was very hard to get on the stage and really do it, coming from this family.
Your mother was born in America. Your father came here when he was very young. So they both spoke English well, right?
Very well, yes. So they both played in the American theater.
Oh, they did? Okay,
oh, yes.
I was going to ask you about that, because I figured, they're of the generation that didn't have to play on the Yiddish stage.
Oh, no. My mother played played Shakespeare in the Boston Repertory, and my father was the star of a Romberg musical comedy called Magic Melody.
Oh, so they'd go back and forth?
They could go back and forth, but they were mostly on the Yiddish stage.
You got started in Yiddish theater before working in...
Yes, my first job was with Maurice Schwartz.
Now, why did you want to do that, since you had both options open to you? Why did you want to start on the Yiddish stage?
It was the Depression, and I couldn't get in. I couldn't get into the American stage. But I needed a job, and I figured, well, I'll go to Schwartz, he'll give me a job. I knew he'd give me a job. And he did.
But you left Yiddish theater after a while.
I left Yiddish theater, yes, because, of course, the thing was, the Yiddish theater was already beginning to die out. The thing really was, if you were going to act, you had to do Broadway.
So you were really performing during the last gasp of Yiddish theater, in a way.
Yes,
was
it's
that a
true.
Depressing period to be performing Yiddish theater?
No, it was never depressing. It was, as a matter of fact, if I have to confess it, I found the American, acting in the American theater was sort of disappointing to me.
In what way?
Well, the actors didn't go out after the play. They didn't go and have coffee together. They didn't have affairs with each other. Or if they did, I didn't know about it. It wasn't a life the way it was downtown.
I should mention that you're a writer now. You left acting.
Yes.
Why did you leave?
Well, I had to make a living after I broke up with my husband. And I had my little girl to bring up. And not that he didn't help me, he did. But still, I couldn't rely on the theater anymore. I had to have some kind of income, and I could get an income as a writer.
Was that accepted in the family since, as we've discussed, yes. it was an acting family, a theater
family?
Oh,
no, they were thrilled with anybody that did anything outside of acting. They were thrilled. I had Luther's son was accepted into MIT. That, everybody was so impressed. He was really something. He wasn't, he had a brain. He was something.
Acting wasn't something?
Oh, no, acting was a lot, but the fact that I wrote was very much respected. Everything was respected.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It was delightful.
Lola Adler Rosenfeld is the author of The Yiddish Theater and Jacob P. Adler, published by Schapolsky Books. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is you following?
Well, Panama is back in the news tonight. There have been reports that a deal has been agreed to and that Noriega is going to leave the country. But Panamanians say that no deal has been agreed to, and in fact, none has been put on the table. Also a story on another possible deal, this one between the Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant and the state of New York. After years of controversy, it looks like the Shoreham plant will finally be shut down and shut down for good. We also visit a little-known medical museum founded during the Civil War. It has bullets, brains, body parts, and Garfield's vertebrae.
Okay, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Guest film critic Michael Schrago joins us with a review of High Tide. It's an Australian film that recently won the Best Picture Award at the Euston International Film Festival.
High Tide is a robust and tender movie about mothers and daughters. It depicts the ties that bind and strangle with humor and compassion. This latest breakthrough by Australian director Gillian Armstrong, who made My Brilliant Career and Mrs. Sofel, is a genuine feat of movie making. It's a deft, atmospheric drama about a separated mother and daughter and the grandmother who comes between them. It gets at the emotions that ebb and flow in families at a level deeper than any family member can face or comprehend. The heroine of High Tide is Lily, a roving ex-parent and a backup singer for an Elvis impersonator. Near the start of the movie, she gets stuck in a small Australian oceanside town. It's the same one where her late husband's mother, Bette, has settled with Lily's daughter, Allie. Lily left Allie with Bette 13 years ago, when the girl was still an infant. Lily was devastated by her husband's sudden death, and when Allie brings those emotions back, Lily still isn't sure she can love her daughter or stick by her. In this baby-crazy era, High Tide dares to assert that a wife's love for her husband can go even deeper than a mother's love for a child. Here, Lily tries to explain that to Allie.
After he died, I wanted to die. I was so angry, you know, and I felt useless because I couldn't ever bring him back. I couldn't have coped with you. I would have been bad for you. So it's my fault. It's not your fault. It's my fault. You mustn't blame yourself.
Then you just stopped loving me.
No, no. I didn't just stop. I stopped myself. I prevented myself. I didn't love anyone. I mean, I didn't choose to stop loving you. It just happened.
Meanwhile, Bette is terrified that Lily will take Allie back. The quarrels that erupt between Lily and her mother-in-law are full of guilt, disappointment, and self-loathing.
What did you tell her about me? That you did?
Of course.
Well, I had to. You screwed up my boy's life. You carted him off all around the countryside.
No, no bit. No more.
Damn it, you were the one who pissed off. Well, I did it to protect you.
To protect yourself. To protect yourself. Because you're a greedy old woman, Beth. Why blame me for John? Why blame anybody?
I don't blame you.
Where were you when he died?
Director Armstrong fashioned cinematic equivalents of Second Sight, or of Seventh and Eighth Senses. High tide flows on a tide of instinct. And that's partly provided by the hypnotic Judy Davis, who first worked with Armstrong on My Brilliant Career and was misquested in David Lean's A Passage to India. Davis is an actress whose ability to transmit unsettled emotions borders on the telepathic. As Lily, she's both down-to-earth and troublingly, touchingly confused. She seems to represent every adult torn between rootless adventure and the hope and burden of a family. She's racing blindly toward the future when the past trips her up. Davis gives a Promethean performance. She expands the entire movie. This film doesn't settle for easy answers. For Lily, the tug-of-war between commitment and freedom will never end. High Tide is a universal family drama, but it's also a welcome antidote to the you-can-have-it-all mythology that sprung up around the baby boomer's baby boom.
Michael Schrago is movie critic for the San Francisco Examiner. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. William Balcom is best known for his performances of American popular song with his wife Joan Morris. But on the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about his own compositions, which just earned him a Pulitzer Prize. Also, singer Susanna McCorkle will continue her month-long tribute to Irving Berlin with a couple of songs from Annie Get Your Gun. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone will review the Broadway play M. Butterfly, starring John Lithgow. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landerl. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.